Well, what could be more American than the 4th of July weekend? Hot dogs, apple pie, fireworks, flags, parades. It's a special time of celebration and one that we all enjoy, partly because of the time of year. It's usually a nice weather weekend. It certainly is this time around. And we look back on and consider some of the blessings that we have. We celebrate the birth of our nation. From our perspective, I think we can appreciate more than others the incredible blessings that this nation has benefited from. We know that they are a direct blessing from God through his promises to Abraham. And in the history of the world, there's never been a nation that has enjoyed such wealth and stability and generally peace. But of course, independence didn't happen on Independence Day. That was the day when the leaders of the nation announced that the 13 colonies would be separating and would be choosing independence from Great Britain. In truth, of course, the 13 colonies weren't really united yet, although they had taken the name United States. There was much confusion and much that separated them, but the one thing they did agree on fully was the rejection of the government of Great Britain. Independence Day was actually the beginning of a long and bloody war that continued for more than 5 years. Lord Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown in October 1781, marking the end of the Revolutionary War. But even at that, our new young nation wasn't finished yet dealing with Great Britain. Great Britain and the United States were again at war beginning in 1812, continuing on through 1815. In fact, at one point in 1814, the British invaded the United States and actually burned the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The end of that war was marked by the signing of the Treaty of Ghent in Europe. And finally, the United States and Great Britain were at peace. We haven't had a war with our Ephraimite brothers since. The point is that Independence Day was just the beginning of our nation's struggles. And sadly, here we are, 240 years later, and we're still at war. Not with Britain, but in this case, at this time in our history, we're at war against really a far more cunning and brutal enemy. As we celebrate this weekend, we all kind of cautiously and with a wary eye look around, always concerned and aware of the ongoing threat of terrorism, specifically Islamic terrorism, as those have vowed to destroy our nation. Just last week, there was another terrorist attack, this one in Bangladesh. Last month, there was one in Orlando. A few weeks, months before that, San Bernardino. Then there was Paris and Brussels. It seems that the attacks are becoming more frequent and more deadly. And we wonder when, where, and what will happen next. Terrorism within the United States is relatively new. The first terroristic attack in the United States was probably in 1993 when the World Trade Center was bombed. It was the first time that the terrorists tried to take down the World Trade Center. They learned from that effort because the next time around in 2001, September 11th, they succeeded. There's a constant threat and fear that the worst is still to come. Now, I don't want to be negative or take away from the celebration that we can enjoy this weekend, but I think it's important to remember that we live in a dangerous world. There are groups out there, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, ISIS, and others, who have a deep-seated hatred for the nation that we love, as well as other nations, France, Belgium, Britain, Australia, Canada. The question we might ask ourselves is, how did we get into this mess? How did these things come about? And as we look at the future, we recognize that there will be other events that will take place. Why? What is going to happen? It's very painful for us to look at the nation that we know God has blessed so much and see that in so many ways, whether you're talking about this terroristic attacks or threats or the moral decline, crime, economy, whatever area you want to look at, we see so many problems. And it's painful to see our nation struggling as we are. But again, how do we get into this situation where terrorism has become such a threat? Well, this afternoon, I want to take some time to go back and review a little bit about how this has come about. My purpose is to review some basic history with you. I know that many of you are very familiar with that history. But I think if we want to look ahead to the future and talk about prophecies that have to do with the United States, with the Middle East, with the general challenge or threat of terrorism, it's important, first of all, to build on an historical background so that we can discuss those prophecies of events that are still to come. It'll help us understand better some of the day-to-day events as we see them in a bigger context. And I think it can also help us to see that God is still fulfilling his plan. We may wonder at times as we see so many problems develop, but we can be assured that God has not abandoned his people, his physical nation of Israel, nor, of course, his church. God is actively fulfilling his plan. But sometimes the things that we see happening are very unpleasant and downright worrisome. The title I've given to the sermon today is Origins of Terrorism. I want to deal with the general question in a fairly general way. Where and how did this all begin? Now, if we want to look for origins of things in Scripture, the best place to start is in the book of Genesis. Even the name or Genesis means beginnings or origins. And in this book, we'll find the origins of two cultures and how they have become bitter enemies. How it affected the initial establishing of those families from which those cultures were developed. And we'll see some hints that we'll build on later as to what is still to come. So today we're going to review some history so that we can soon begin to look more fully at prophecy. We'll begin in the book of, we'll be in the book of Genesis for the message today, and we're going to pick up the story in chapter 12. Now, chapter 12 is probably 1,500 or 1,600 years from the very beginning, which starts in chapter 1, of course. A lot has happened, and including in the previous few chapters, the destruction of all of the earth and mankind, except for the family of Noah in the flood, and the beginning, the rebuilding of civilization. And one of the first things rebuilt, of course, is the pagan and rebellious efforts to reject God. We see the story of the Tower of Babel in chapter 11. We're going to pick up the story in chapter 12 because it begins the history of how God is developing his physical nation of Israel and later parallel the spiritual nation, his church. Chapter 12. Well, in chapter 11, I'm sorry, if you go back and see the beginning of verse 27, you see the genealogy of a man named Terah, who was a descendant of Seth. And Terah has sons named Abram, Nahor, and Haran. and Haran has a son named Lot. We're familiar in this list with Abraham or Abram and Lot. Terah says in verse 31, which took his son Abram and his grandson Lot and some other members of the family, and they left Ur, which is in near the city of, near Babylon, Ur of the Chaldeans, and he was on his way to the land of Canaan. And in verse 32, we see that Terah, along the way, was 205 years old, and he died in a place called Haran, which is north of the land of Canaan. And they were most of the way there, partway there, when Terah died. And so there was Abram and his wife and his nephew, and they were in this region. They could have just settled right there. They may have considered doing that, or they may have been considering going back to Ur. But at this point, God intervenes in Abram's life. Chapter 12, verse 1 says, "The Lord said to Abram." Now, we don't know at this point what relationship or connection God had with Abram before. What God saw in Abram exactly that led him to make this choice to have him be the one that he would work through. We do know that over the intervening years, Abram expressed a great deal of faith and confidence in God, and was very faithful to him. But how this relationship was established or what it was initially built on is something we just don't see. But we see God communicating with Abram. He tells him in verse 1, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you." So he was urged, instructed not to go back to Ur, but to continue on someplace else. "Go to a land that I will show you. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram leaves his homeland. He takes God at his word. Verse 4, Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and he took his nephew Lot along with him. And we also see in this verse that Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now, even to me, that seems like it's fairly old. But in Abram's case, he lived to be 175. So he wasn't even yet at middle age, at the age of 75. So God began to work with Abram at that point. We pick up the story. We're going to be skipping around a little bit, or skipping over some of the details and just get the highlights. We'll go to chapter 15. Remember, we saw in chapter 12 that he would become a great nation, and that through him all the other nations would be blessed. In order to become a great nation, you've got to have a family, right? Let's pick up the story in chapter 15. These things, the word of the Lord, after these things, that this is when he'd rescued Lot and then paid tithe to Melchizedek. After those events took place, the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." So again, God continued to make promises to Abram, and Abram responded and believed and put his faith and confidence in God and obeyed him. But Abram was a bit concerned. Verse 2, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing that I go childless and that the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" So since he had no children, if something were to happen to him, what he had would be inherited by a man who had been born in his house as one of his servants. So he said, continuing in verse 3, "Look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born to my house is my heir." So Abram was becoming a bit concerned, wondering how it was that the promise that had been made to him was going to be fulfilled. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." He brought him outside. He had him look at the sky and said, "If you can count the number of stars, then that will be the number of your descendants." Verse 6, Abram believed God. Abram had faith that God was going to fulfill his promise. Chapter 16. More time has passed. Abram still does not have a son. Verse 1, chapter 16. Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, here's the thought. The Lord has restrained me from bearing children, so please go into my maid, and perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So now 10 years have passed. God has at least, as recorded, promised twice that Abram would be the father of nations and that he would have more descendants than there are stars in the sky, assuring Abram of his plan for him. Abram seems still to have believed and had faith that God would fulfill his promise. But he and his wife apparently reasoned that perhaps Sarai would not be the mother. Abram would be the father. That had been specifically stated. But in those earlier promises, Sarai was not directly mentioned. So at his wife's urging, he took an Egyptian wife, Hagar. And it says in verse 16 that Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. So, success. Abram has an heir. Abram has a son now that can develop, from whom can spring this nation, this great nation that God had promised that Abram would have. But of course, this kind of thing always has a personal side to it. Sarai regretted and was jealous of what had happened. She was very harsh to Hagar, and to the point where Hagar just had to get out of there. She fled from Sarai, who was treating her so very harshly. As she fled, she came into very dire circumstances and needed to be rescued, and she called out to God, and God heard her prayer and her cry for help. And he gave her a promise regarding the child that she would bear. Verse 11 says, the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you're with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Now, good news, bad news. Hagar was going to have a son, and both of them were going to survive this ordeal that they were looking at, but the prophecy for what kind of life Ishmael was going to have doesn't sound all that pleasant. He's going to be a wild man. He's going to have to live by his own strength and his own wits. He'll be against others, and others will be against him, and he's going to dwell in the presence of his brethren. He would live around the edges. He would not be a part of the other branches of his family. And he would have to fight and scrap and scramble to survive, but he would. He would survive. So this is the situation where Abram has his firstborn son. A couple of things to notice. First of all, Hagar was Egyptian. So Ishmael then, Abram's son, was half Egyptian. We also know from secular history that the Arab people understand that they descended from Ishmael. That's something that they commonly understand and recognize. And they see themselves as descendants of Abraham through their father, Ishmael. So Hagar was Egyptian, and Ishmael was then half Egyptian. Sarai, however, was of the same ethnicity as Abraham. She was his half-sister. And so they had the same family line. Abraham, his father Terah, his half-sister wife Sarai, had all descended from Shem, one of Noah's sons. You can see that in Genesis 11. So there's an important distinction between the two wives, that one is Egyptian and the other is of the same ethnic heritage as Abraham. You can't really call him a Jew or an Israelite, because the Jews and Israelites were his grandchildren. He's called in Scripture a Hebrew, but he was then the father of the grandfather of the man, the one who had the 12 sons of Israel. So there's some problems in paradise, even though on one hand the problem seems to be resolved. It was resolved by Abraham and Sarai's efforts, not the way that God intended it. So notice chapter 17, verse 15. Chapter 17, verse 15, God said to Abraham, and this was the point where he changed his name from Abram to Abraham, and we'll see he changes Sarai to Sarah. And I'm glad to get past that point so I can refer to them as Abraham and Sarah. God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her." So Ishmael was not the solution. We'll see that Ishmael was really kind of a complication as far as the family life, at least, for Abraham and Sarah. So Abraham fell on his face, verse 17, and he laughed, and he said in his heart, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100, and shall Sarah, who is 90, also bear a child?" Now, it says that he laughed. He wasn't doubting God. He wasn't mocking God. He just was probably a little bit giddy, a little bit excited, a little bit confused. And so sometimes we react a bit oddly when we're under those kind of circumstances. And so he was just kind of taken aback by the whole thing. Because again, he thought that this was solved. That he had a firstborn son. In fact, in verse 18, Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." See, at this point, Ishmael was probably 13, 14 years old. He had lived with his father and his stepmother all that period of time, and undoubtedly Abraham and Ishmael had bonded and grown close together. In fact, I would assume that Abraham had even told Ishmael about the promises that had been given to him, and that through his son he would have a great nation, and that Ishmael was brought up probably looking forward to receiving those blessings, to be the one that God had chosen. But God said, "No, Sarah will bear you a son, and you'll call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him." So God had his own plan. Abraham and Sarah and their efforts were not able to do God's work for him. He had a plan in mind of his own. Let's skip ahead to chapter 24. Isaac, in the meantime, has himself grown. And as he reached nearing the age of 40, as we'll see here in this chapter, Abraham was concerned about finding a wife for his son Isaac. And Abraham, it says in verse 1 of chapter 24, was old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham now is looking forward to what's going to happen next. And he sends his a servant to his family in Haran to seek a wife for Isaac. You see, again, we see, and we'll see it emphasized as we continue, that God was developing two distinctly different lines of descendants, two distinct families. And the family that would bear his name and the promises would be fulfilled within them would be the family that the wife in both Sarai and now Rebekah, who will be the wife of Isaac, are from the same lineage as Abraham. Verse 4, you shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. The previous verse says not to get a wife for him from the land of the Canaanites. God was separating out and establishing the people or the family line of Abraham. Chapter 25, verse 20. Chapter 25, verse 20. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as his wife. Rebekah was his cousin. She was the daughter of within the family of Abraham, daughter of one of his brothers. The daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. So he is within the family then of Abraham. Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So just as Sarah had been barren into much later years in her life, Rebekah was initially barren as well. God blessed her with the conception. And in verse 22, it turns out they were twins. The children struggled together within her. And she said, well, if everything's okay, then what's going on here? What's happening? You know, babies move and they kick and they show some life. But this was more than that. This was an actual struggle that was taking place within her womb. And she was worried about what was happening. So she inquired of the Lord. Verse 23, he said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. The twin sons who were to be born to Rebekah were going to develop into these two nations that God would establish, both of whom are descendants of Abraham, but who would also be bitter rivals. And it says that contrary to what was normal, the younger son was to be the dominant one. In the tradition and the culture, the older son, the firstborn son, was the one who had special rights and privileges and responsibilities. It was an exception for the younger son to be given those opportunities. There are other examples in Scripture, again, even though it's not common, of the younger son receiving the greater blessing. We saw that just a moment ago with Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael was older. Isaac was the birthright son. We see it with Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh was the older, but Jacob gave the greater blessing to Ephraim. So it's not that it doesn't happen, but it's not typical. Esau, as the firstborn, even though he probably was born just a few minutes before his twin brother, was the firstborn of Isaac. The oldest son was to have more responsibilities, more rights, more privileges than sons who were born later. As a birthright son, the firstborn, he was to receive a double portion of the family inheritance, along with a special blessing from his father. And he would be given the position of family patriarch, to be the head of his family. So being the firstborn son was no small thing. It was very important, had a lot to do with the responsibilities and opportunities that he would have. But again, the older will serve the younger, was God's plan for these two boys. Verse 24, when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called him Rusty, or Red, which is what Esau means. And afterward came out, his brother came out with his hand holding the heel of Esau. So they named him Grabby. He was in the womb, probably the one who was causing all the ruckus and the difficulty. It's clear that by nature, by his temperament, Jacob was aggressive and ambitious and competitive. Even before he was born, he had such strong proclivities. He wanted to take the place of Esau. The name Jacob means a supplanter, one who supersedes or displaces another. It also can mean deceitful. So the names that were given to these two newborn twins were very much in keeping with what they would become, with their personality or their proclivities or nature. So the boys grew, it says in verse 27. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Esau was a manly man. Esau was a hunter. Esau lived in the woods or in the wilderness. That's where he was most comfortable. And he felt at home under those circumstances. But Jacob, it says, was a mild man. Now, the word mild is not a very good translation. It makes it sound as if Jacob was somehow weak. The word mild, it comes from a Hebrew word that means balanced or complete. Balanced or complete. In other words, Jacob, frankly, was well suited for the responsibilities that he would someday have. He was complete. He was the whole package. He was strong. He was good-looking. He wasn't just an outdoorsman, although he probably could handle himself just fine, but he was more balanced overall in his life. And he lived at home. He didn't have to be out in the woods all the time. Must have added some difficulty to the household because Isaac favored Esau, Rebekah favored Jacob. But that may have added to even the rivalry that the boys or the young men had as they grew older. But both of these men were capable as they grew up. They were cunning and they were skilled. Esau used his strength to take care of himself and to be the successful outdoorsman and hunter. Jacob used his strengths in a deceitful way. He tended to manipulate and take advantage to try to gain for himself. In verse 29, it says that Jacob cooked a stew and Esau came in from the field and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I'm weary." Therefore, his name was called Edom. So Jacob apparently was pretty handy in the kitchen, and he was making a nice big meaty stew. And along came Esau, must have had a tough day hunting because he didn't seem to have anything to show for it. But he was really exhausted, terribly hungry. And he didn't know how to take care of himself in that situation. So he said that I'm weary. And he needed to be fed, needed to be taken care of right now. I guess this tells us something about Esau's character or personality, that he wasn't able to take care of himself, and he wasn't able to wait. I mean, how, if he's back with his family, how long would it take to get something? It was kind of a short-sighted individual, it would seem. Doesn't say where Jacob was when he was making this meal. Maybe he was away from the household. Maybe, I don't know the circumstances. But Esau was very weak and very hungry, and he begged Jacob to share the meal. So Jacob, being the deceitful supplanter kind of guy that he was, saw the opportunity. Yeah, sure, I'll share my stew with you, if you give me your birthright. That seems like a pretty unequal trade to our mind, and certainly it was. But Esau apparently reasoned that, well, you know what, if I starve to death, what good is a birthright going to do me? So he took the short-sighted, quick answer, and he said that he took a vow to give over his birthright to Jacob for the price of a bowl of red stew. By the way, the red stew, it says here, he says, therefore his name was called Edom, which again means red. So you'll see other prophecies later about Edom, and they relate to descendants of Esau. Esau, it says in verse 34, despised his birthright. He despised it, meaning that it didn't really mean anything to him. He didn't see the value of it. He had a short-sighted concern about the meal that he wanted right now, and he gave up something that was far more valuable. And it's almost, we would think of it as absurd to make that kind of a trade. But in Esau's mind, since he didn't respect or value the birthright, it was a trade that he was willing to make. And Jacob was willing to take advantage. So Jacob has taken the birthright from Esau. And now it's time, we go to chapter 24, as Isaac approaches the end of his life, to pass along the formally pass along the blessing, which means the promises that God had given to Abraham. These promises, as we saw earlier, were to be extended to Isaac and would generally go to the firstborn, really as part of his birthright. This chapter includes the story, I'm sure you're familiar with it, of how Jacob deviously took the blessing from Esau. Now, I wouldn't say that he actually stole the blessing, but again, he manipulated and he lied so that he would take the birthright. You see, we saw earlier, before these boys were even born, that God's intent was that the younger of the two would be the one who would be dominant. God intended all along for Jacob to be the one who would receive the birthright and the blessings. But kind of like what happened with Abraham and Hagar, Jacob took things into his own hands and did it his way. Again, you see, it only adds to the confusion of the situation. God may well have intended for there to be the division between the families, but however God planned to develop his plan, we can't be sure because we only see what did happen. But there was a great deal of anger and confusion created by the way that Jacob, under the encouragement of his mother, took these promises that had been initially part of what would have gone to Esau. He took matters into his own hands through this deceit. So God gave Jacob I'm sorry, Isaac gave Jacob the blessing, the promises that related to the covenant that Abraham, or that God had made with Abraham. So now let's drop down to chapter 27, verse 38. By the time Jacob had received Isaac's blessing, there was not a lot left for Esau. I'm going to read verses 38 through 40 from the New International. Genesis 27:38. Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too." And he wept aloud. So this was after Esau had learned that Isaac had already given the blessing to Jacob. "Don't you have another one, another blessing that you can share with me?" So his father answered him in verse 39. Here's the blessing given to Isaac to Esau. "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother." Now there's a blessing for you. There wasn't much left for Esau to look forward to, because it would have been passed along to Jacob. Again, the blessings of Abraham had gone from Isaac now to Jacob. But, end of verse 40, "When you grow restless, you will throw away his yoke from off your neck." First of all, notice the similarity between the prophetic blessings given to Ishmael and to Esau. If you turn back to, and I won't read it again, but you could turn back to the blessing that was given to Hagar for her son in chapter 16, and compare that to what we read here, the blessing that was given to Esau in chapter 27, and there are some strong similarities. They would both live on the edge, on the outside, be around the blessings but not receive the blessings. The greater blessings would go to each of their brothers, to Isaac and then to Jacob. But there would come a time when Esau would break away from his brother's dominance. And notice the attitude that Esau expresses in verse 41. It says that Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near." In other words, Isaac would soon die. "When those days are over," he says, "then I will kill my brother Jacob." He had a murderous heart toward his brother Jacob. An ominous threat, which, as we'll see as we continue, the descendants of Esau are still determined to carry out. As always, when we read these Bible accounts, or the stories of things, events that took place, there are lessons to be learned. One of them, as we've noted, is that God intended for Jacob to have the birthright and the blessing. He could have left it in God's hands and received that blessing with probably far fewer complications than what developed. But you know, maybe Jacob's actions were at least partly his mother's fault. Maybe she didn't emphasize or pass along to him. Maybe she didn't have the faith that she needed to have had to recognize from the promise that had been given to her that there's no need to rush in and take these blessings. God was going to give them to Jacob. The older would serve the younger. But of course, Jacob's temperament played into it as well, because we know that he was impatient, he was aggressive, he was deceitful. He took advantage. He didn't have a lot of empathy or heart. He just wanted to get all he could for himself. So as it turned out, Esau was hostile and bitter. He felt he'd been cheated from what should have been his, and that Jacob had taken it from him. Let's move ahead here in chapter 27 to verse 42. after Esau had expressed his rage, his hostility, it says the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. And so she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and flee to my brother Laban in Haran, and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury turns away. And when your brother's anger turns away from you and he forgets what you've done to him," did you really think he was going to forget? "Then I'll send for you, bring you back." And so Jacob was sent to live with family in Haran, which is where Abraham had come from when he came into Canaan. Now notice something else about Jacob fleeing to his family. Chapter 28, verse 1, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." Again, you see, God was carefully separating the two lines of the family. He says, "Go to your mother's father's house and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." So he also was told that he should marry within his family, and specifically he would marry a cousin. The story continues, through chapter 32, we see that Jacob eventually returns after being some 14 or so years, probably more like 20 years, living in the area of his family. He returned home. God preserved Jacob, protected him from the evil intent of Esau, because Jacob was needed to survive. He would have 12 sons who would become the children of Israel, as Jacob's name was changed, and they would grow into the nation of Israel. But go back to where we were just a moment ago, where the time when Jacob was sent away, we find another incident here that shows the kind of person that Esau had become. Chapter 28, verse 6. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." And Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and gone there. So, verse 8, Esau also saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father. So, what did he do? He went to Ishmael, his uncle, and he took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son. He defiantly and intentionally married into the Egyptian side of the family. He expressed his disdain both for his family, for his lineage, and also for the instruction or the charge that had been given to his brother Jacob. This, again, distinctly separates the two family lines: those who would become the nations of Israel and those who would become the Arab peoples. Now notice, just as we start to wrap things up for now, remember that there were others in the region as well, besides the two family lines of Abraham. There were the Canaanites, who Isaac specifically told Jacob not to marry into. The Canaanites were primarily descendants of Noah's son, Ham. You read the Genesis 11 about his descendants, one of whom was named Canaan. There also were the Philistines. The Philistines were a tribe who had migrated into Canaan from Egypt. And the Philistines, of course, were a real problem for the nation of Israel for generations. There were the Moabites and the Ammonites. Moab and Ammon were the sons of Lot by his daughters. Remember when they were expelled or they escaped from the city of Sodom. And they were sons that were born to Lot's daughters. So there was quite a mix of different ethnicities and races and groups of people in the region. In order to establish what would be his family line, God carefully separated the family of Abraham from all of those others. You may remember also, as it says in Genesis 25, that Abraham married again after Sarah had died. Genesis chapter 25, he took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And then it lists the sons that he had by Keturah. Even as he grew older, he had a number of sons. And by this woman, doesn't say here what her lineage was, but it does tell us about the children or the sons that Abraham had with her. Verse 5, it says that Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, and while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, to the country to the east. To the east of Canaan, you'll find places like Syria, Jordan, Iraq, where these sons of Abraham, by the concubines or other wives that he had, were presumably absorbed into the Arab world. So, of all the peoples in that region, only Abraham's family were small in number compared to the others, and they were the ones that God had set aside and would work through. But we see in these chapters of Genesis the origin of two distinct cultures. And again, the Arabs fully recognize that they are descendants through Ishmael and Esau of Abraham. And we see that the bitterness and hostility that they had at that time is something that has continued. As we look at later periods of history, which we'll get into as we continue, is looking into and also looking at prophecies about the descendants of Edom and their interaction with the people of Israel, including Judah in the Middle East, and also how it will affect our nation. We'll see that that bitterness and that hostility has always existed. It became a religious rivalry in the 7th century, in the 600s, when Muhammad developed the Muslim religion, Islam, and added a religious element to the situation as well. Thousands of years later, the hostilities that led to the hatred and to the strife between these two lines of Abraham have continued. And now there is a group of those who are descended from that other line of Abraham's family who continue to be determined to destroy the descendants of Abraham, the descendants of Jacob in particular. So, with a little bit of background then, how the circumstances developed, I hope that will help us as we continue on in future sermons to see the context of prophecies that have to do with the Middle East, with the people of the Middle East, and how those will develop as God continues to set the stage for Jesus Christ's return. And we can see the origins the beginning of the hatred, the bitterness, the hostility that exists in that region.